How did you happen to get in here?
I ran here. You scared the daylights out of me last night.
Seems like the truth shouldn't scare anybody, man or boy.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 15 of Dragon King Dark. I'm your host, Carl Stern. Thanks a lot for listening to the show. Again, this is the 15th episode, and I hope you've been enjoying the series so far. Our last episode, if you missed it, check it there on the archives at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. It was all about dreams and dreaming. If you would like to send feedback to any of our shows, follow-ups, thoughts of your own, even suggestions, please do so. The email address for all of the shows I do is carl at dragonkingcarl.com. That is Carl with letter K, K-A-R-L at dragonkingcarl.com. If you would, if you're responding to Dragon King Dark, would you please put Dragon King Dark in the subject line so I can just, it makes it easier to differentiate between that and the other podcasts I do. And that way I can get to it in a more efficient manner. Hope you'll go back and check out all the shows. They are all available in the archives here at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. If you do happen to purchase a Super Stern Stick flash drive from my website, DragonKingCarl.com, I am including the archives to this show on there as well. And we've talked about a variety of subject matters. Today, we're going to talk about something that I found. It kind of relates back to episode 13, which was the 1950s comic book series, where I talked about, you know, back in the 1950s, it seems like there was a fascination with death and graveyards and the macabre and just grave robbing and things like that. This show is not about comics at all. It's sort of related to that same theme. I want to go back and look at something that is a completely, I hate to call it a lost art because it's not really an art form, but that is old obituaries, old newspaper obituaries. Today, obituaries are by and large just very dry, matter-of-factual statements about the passing of a loved one. They're really, no real information can be gleaned from them. It's all about just what time the services for someone who's deceased is, who some of their immediate family members is, and sometimes a photograph, whether they served in the military or something like that. That's pretty much just, I mean, just very dry, matter-of-factual stuff. Back in the early 1900s, late 1800s, not so much. They were quite colorful, oftentimes talked, sometimes in excruciating detail about the cause of death. The person's religious beliefs were, of course, first and foremost in there. It was a time really in America and in a lot of the world where people wore their religion, and usually that was Christianity here in the United States, proudly on their sleeve. It was a badge of honor, and so it was prominently, the status of their everlasting soul was prominently displayed in their obituaries. And these were actually later on, I've done an extensive family history myself, and these old obituaries were very helpful in establishing family members, other genealogies that were important to my family timeline and stuff. And a lot, you get a lot of details about a person who's perhaps your a few generations later, you probably only knew their name. And these weren't people that even your parents or grandparents had firsthand knowledge of. And so you actually learn a little bit about your ancestors from some of these very colorful obituaries. And so I thought it'd be kind of cool to go back and look at some of these and just see. And again, there is woven in this, if you've listened to us now for all these 14 episodes or so, you've noticed that, or at least 15 episodes now, you've noticed one of the themes that I weave is our fascination with death, our fear of what really happens next, because regardless of your religion, your personal beliefs, your personal background, regardless of how deep in the sciences you are steeped, whether you're a fundamentalist member of a religion so deeply entrenched, or if you're a scientist, a complete and total agnostic or atheist, the truth of the matter is none of us really know what happens to the consciousness at the point of death. Now, we make a lot of assumptions. We make a lot of, we can test things and whatever, but none of us, until we experience that moment of death, really and truly know what's on the other side. And that has long, for as long as man has been conscious, that has been a point of fear for man. And so a lot of these old obituaries, certainly you can read that theme woven throughout. And again, most of these, I've just pulled a few up, and one tremendous story of a wake from the old National Police Gazette magazine. And if you listen to some of my other shows, I do, of course, most of you, I assume, listen to the show. No, I've done a long-running classic professional wrestling show that talks about the old days of pro wrestling. And one of the major source of information from back in the 1800s, early 1900s, was a magazine called the National Police Gazette. And the National Police Gazette, I don't even know what you would compare it to nowadays. It's not, I would say the National Enquirer, but it's way more colorful than that. I would almost say it would be like the World Globe, or, well, you know, some of those tabloids that had like Bat Boy and stuff like that on there. But these were, the National Police Gazette was somewhat grounded in reality. It was kind of, I don't know, it was kind of like TMZ meets the Globe tabloid or something like that. It's just a cross between TMZ and you know, Bat Boy or Son of Satan or something. I don't know. It's this, the craziest thing out there. But there's a tremendous story. One of my favorite National Police Gazette stories. We're going to, you can look forward that before this show is over, I will read to you Battle with Corpse-Eating Cats, from March 1st, 1879. One of my favorite National Police Gazette articles. Complete with drawings. The drawing, back then, of course, there were photographs in these periodicals. There are artist depictions, and there is completely depicted men in suits beating cats with sticks while cats are trying to eat said corpse. It's not a thing I'm making up. But even going back when I was researching like my family's genealogy and stuff, I used, you know, old newspaper accounts from this area. And I come to notice a theme that all over the U.S. from really the mid to early 1800s all the way through kind of the 1920s were kind of the last era of this sort of obituary writing, although some of them did last even into the 1950s. You never see anything like this nowadays. But here, let's give you an example of a few of these. We'll pull them up and where I can find the original source, I'll let you know. Some of these are just excerpts that other people have pulled up and posted online. This is from, let's see here, This would be from, not sure of the, assuming this is North Carolina, so this would be Appalachia. This is Fairfield, but then gives Elizabeth City, which I guess Elizabeth City is actually a mid-Atlantic coast city over in North Carolina. Been to Elizabeth City before, and I noticed this is from something called the Tar Heel, based out of Elizabeth City. So this is eastern North Carolina on the Outer Banks. This is from Friday, the September the 11th, 1903. And this says, since I last wrote, this community has lost one of its best citizens, Mr. Willie Cohoon, a young man widely esteemed, departed from this life at his home near here. He leaves a young wife and two infant children to mourn the loss. He was a good citizen, and his death is a loss to this community in which he had begun to exert an influence for good. Mr. Ambrose, an aged and highly respected citizen of Swan Quarter Township, departed this life. He was a Confederate soldier and as brave a man as ever breasted federal bullets. Another death occurred recently in the Englehard section. This time the messenger claimed Mr. John Piedrick, a highly respected citizen, ripe with more than 75 years' experience. This is by no means a sickly county. On the other hand, we have never had a case of typhoid fever. Most of our people are of old age. We have more citizens over 60 years of age than any county in North Carolina in proportion to our population. So you can see a lot of references of what I'm talking about, and this is a very tame one, actually. You never see this stuff nowadays. Seldom ever is the cause of death listed in an obituary, nor the good character of a person. As you can see here, a brave man, a good citizen, just begun to exert an influence for good. Things were more, they were more complete, kind of black and white in their imagery of good and bad. And they were very much about that. Whereas now, I think in 2016, we realize that there's a lot of shades of gray out there. And so, you know, those things aren't so prominently pointed out in the obituary. And quite honestly, in the eulogies anymore, I seldom hear that much talk about the personal character of the person who's deceased. There's a lot of the funerals I've gone to over the last few years. You get a lot of just, you know, facts and general family information about the person, and maybe a little bit if he had a long-term career or something like that, you'll get that. But they don't seem to delve as much anymore about the personal integrity or code of honor of people like they used to. Here from the same paper, the Tar Heel, this one dated December the 4th, 1903, death of Mrs. Simmons, Mrs. Lizina Simmons, wife of Dr. P.H. Simmons, and mother of Captain Benjamin Simmons of the U.S. Army, died Saturday, the 28th, after a short illness. She leaves a husband and three children and a host of friends to mourn her loss. She was a most estimable woman who was the finest embodiment of the attributes of a Christian character. So again, a lot of these old ones put a lot of emphasis on their religious beliefs. This one I found interesting. Mr. Preston Carter had the misfortune to get a finger badly damaged by the explosion of a shell while trying to load his gun a few days ago. He had the same hand ruined a few years ago by a similar accident. You know, nowadays we would call that too much information. But back then, there was a lot. I mean, it was a lot of this type stuff. This is actually one of the papers I used back to research my family history. This is from, if you've heard me talk about before, I'm from Northwest Alabama, our county, and some of the surrounding area actually attempted to secede from the state of Alabama during the Civil War, we were called Tories, and we were not union. We were not Confederate loyalist, and so we were actually persecuted by both the North and South during the Civil War. It was a very rural county. This paper was called the Winston Herald, and I've actually found some stuff about my family in here while researching. Here's an example of some of the obituaries from there. And again, you'll see a lot of very colorful language regarding the religious beliefs of the departed. Melville, Alabama, April 3rd, 1893. Ed Harold, brother Levi W. Addy of Melville, quietly passed away Sunday at 1 a.m. April 2nd. The funeral will take place at Mount Hope Church, Monday 3rd, 11 a.m., conducted by D.L. Wright, his pastor, and his remains will be deposited in the Mount Hope Cemetery. Death loves a shining mark. Truly a good man has passed away, one whom the people of Winston were always glad to welcome to their hearths and homes. A man respected and loved by all who knew him, an ardent church worker, always taking a lead in nearly all Christian endeavors. The Hope drapes a column in mourning in memory of Brother Addy, who has been, up till he was confined to his room by his last illness, a faithful contributor to our columns. We do not turn the column rule because we have no hope for his future happiness, for we have every reason to believe that while his body is sleeping on the green hills of old Winston, his soul is resting in the paradise of God. We feel assured of this fact, but we still feel sad when we know that we shall never look upon his face again or grasp his hand as a greeting of friendship. But why should we mourn? Is not even death a gain to those whose life to God was given? Gladly to earth their eyes they close to open them in heaven. To his dear companion and two daughters, we offer our heartfelt sympathy. On Easter Sunday, his body lay a lifeless lump of clay. But we know that Christ is the first fruit of the resurrection, and that when our Father's own good time comes, we shall behold his body glorified and freed from sin. So, you know, you would never see an obituary like that today. How about this little jewel for just coldness? January 6th, 1899. This is from the New Era newspaper. January 6th, 1899. Little Johnny, the baby girl of Mr. and Mrs. John S. Curtis of this city, died last Saturday night, 31st of December, after several weeks of intense suffering, and was buried Sunday. Here's a good one giving the cause of death. This is January 6th, 1899. J. Edwin Adkins, age 24, youngest son of Mr. and Mrs. W.R. Adkins, died at Thornton, Arkansas on the 30th of December, 1899, from injuries received in a train wreck near that place. Here's a good wording I like. Again, you would never see this in today's world. January the 13th, 1899. Reverend William J. Tingle breathed his last breath the 29th of November, 1898. Brother Tingle leaves a devoted wife, three children, an aged mother, five brothers, and one sister. He was interred in Bethel Cemetery at 4 p.m. and the 1st of December with Masonic honors. Brother Tingle was born the 1st of March, 1850, professed a hope in Christ about 23 years ago, and joined the Missionary Baptist Church. Colorful language used in this one, and bluntness as well. January the 27th, 1899, Edgar Lee Blackwell is dead. He was the son of J.C. and Eliza Blackwell. He was born the 28th of July, 1882. And died the 21st of January, 1899. Aged 16 years, 5 months, and 23 days, he was taken sick on the 13th and died the 21st of January, 1899, with the most dreaded disease, pneumonia. This one is from July 7th, 1899, and it actually references a dead town. In fact, I live near this dead town. This town hasn't existed since probably around this time. It was a town called Moats, and this is just a few miles from where I live. There's no remnants of this settlement community anymore. It's nothing there but heavy forest, no even hint that there was anything ever there. But it says, about 10 o'clock Wednesday night, Mr. D.S. McCullough, one of the most prominent citizens of the county, died at Moats. He had been sick about 3 weeks with typhoid fever. Apparently in 1899, 1900, there was a lot of typhoid fever in this county. It's here again, it's referenced January 5th, 1900. Again, pay attention to the wording of this obituary. January 5th, 1900, death again has invaded the home of Mr. C.A. Curtis. Wednesday morning, taking as its victim his little daughter, Murty, who had been lingering with typhoid fever for several days. Only a few weeks ago, death claimed her dear mother. This one I always love. I want this worded into my obituary somehow. The death angel visited Arlie Friday night, March 23rd, 1906, and took from our midst Mr. L.R. Jean, an aged father. His remains were brought here yesterday. The burial took place in Kemp Cemetery. I definitely want reference to the death angel in my obituary. This is not an obituary, but I had to include it because it's just fantastic. And again, certainly not a thing you would read today in the newspaper, but in fact, today you go to prison for this, but this is from January 25th, 1907. James G. Martin and Miss Maggie Hugh Martin, both of Mount Hope, were married at the courthouse yesterday by Judge Curtis. There were parental objections, and the couple, quote, ran away from the old folks. The young lady was exceedingly pretty, and the general verdict is that the young man was perfectly justified in stealing her. That is an actual legitimate article from a 1907 newspaper. I don't know whether to applaud or gasp at the, quote, undertaker for this one. March 29th, 1907, Benjamin F. Berry, one of Winston's most illustrious sons, born a few miles west of here in this county in 1866, and died the 20th of March, 1907 in Memphis, Tennessee. He was buried in the cemetery at Union Grove near his old home. The undertaker wrote on his coffin, cause of death, cancer of the liver. Now, I don't know what we call this today, although it sounds like something you could take some Benadryl for and cure. But March 29th, 1907, Mr. and Mrs. Wise Gibson found their five-month-old baby dead in the bed Friday morning. The remains were buried in the Haleyville Cemetery Saturday. It was thought bold hives was the cause of death. And those are from some of my couple of my local newspapers from back in the day. But this tops them all. And again, the National Police Gazette. Boy, I love the National Police Gazette. Here's what Wikipedia has to say about the Police Gazette before I get to this fantastic article. The National Police Gazette, commonly referred to simply as the Police Gazette, was an American magazine founded in 1845 under publisher Richard K. Fox. It became the forerunner of men's lifestyle magazines, the Illustrated Sports Weekly, the Girly Pinup Magazine, the Celebrity Gossip Column, Guinness World Records style competitions, and modern tabloid sensationalized journalism. And boy, are you, boy, is that accurate. The magazine was founded by two journalists, Enoch E. Camp, also an attorney, and George Wilkes, a Transcontinental Railroad booster. It began as a chronicler of crime and criminals, intended for consumption by the general public. In 1866, Wilkes and Camp sold the Gazette to George W. Matzel. the editor and proprietor from 1877 until his death in 1922, was Richard Kyle Fox, an immigrant from Ireland. Ostensibly devoted to matters of public interest to the police, it is a tabloid-like publication with lurid coverage of murders, Wild West outlaws, and sport. It is well known for its engravings and photographs of scantily clad strippers, burlesque dancers, and prostitutes, often skirting on the edge of what is legally considered obscenity. The National Police Gazette enjoyed considerable popularity in the late 19th century and early decades of the 20th century, but its popularity decreased during the Great Depression. In 1932, the Police Gazette ceased publication and was sold at auction for a nominal sum. A year later, it was revived under the ownership of the Donafields, who placed it in the editorial hands of Mrs. Merle W. Hershey, the ex-wife of Harold Hershey. The Donfield-Hershey regime did not last long, and the magazine changed hands again within a year. The National Police Gazette continued as a monthly publication for many years before ceasing print in 1977. In its heyday, it was immensely influential. In the first part of the 20th century, the United States became the center for professional boxing. It was generally accepted that the world champions were those listed by the Police Gazette, and after 1920, the World Boxing Association began to sanction title fights. The same could be said, although not listed in the article, for professional wrestling as well. In 1896, the Police Gazette also allegedly offered a prize of $10,000 to the first to row across the Atlantic Ocean, though no contemporary source exists confirming a Police Gazette offer of any significant monetary prize. In the same year, George Harbaugh and Frank Samuelson invested their savings in an 18-foot rowboat, which they named Fox after the editor of the Gazette, Richard K. Fox. Despite crossing the Atlantic in 55 days, a record that was not broken until 2010, albeit by a team of four rowers, the Police Gazette never paid the men the promised prize money, though no contemporary source again exists showing the money was ever offered by the Police Gazette or that the men were expecting a substantial sum from the Gazette. Numerous sources report the men were expecting either no money or only whatever money could be raised from exhibitions following successful completion of the voyage. Sources also show Richard K. Fox and the Police Gazette offered and provided towing of the Fox to Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, the last outside propulsion used by Harbaugh and Samuelson until reaching Europe. Payment of expenses incurred by the American consulate in Le Havre for their food, clothing, and temporary shelter upon reaching the continent, two gold medals commemorating the achievement, and a publicity within the pages of the Police Gazette. The Gazette was also the only newspaper willing to attach its name to the endeavor, as others considered it too risky. On July 27, 1901, appeared as one of the National Police Gazette headlines for review of popular entertainers, paragraphs of interest concerning the stage lives and doing of vaudeville people. Here can be found many items which will interest performers as well as theater goers. Professionals are requested to send in photos. On the list of favorably reviewed entertainers that included ventriloquists, minstrels, songsters, aerialists, and comedians was listed Pat H. Chappelle and the Rabbit Foot Company, among many other vaudeville shows. So now that's what the Police Gazette was. Let's see what the Police Gazette did. This article is tremendous. It is from March 1st, 1879. Battle with Corpse-Eating Cats. At New Albany, Indiana, a remarkable scene recently occurred in that part of the city called Hog Hollow. One Daniel Sheehan, a former employee of the glassworks, who lived in a small frame building in the locality referred to, died suddenly. At night, some young people gathered to watch over the remains, but becoming, as the widow thought, a little too noisy, they were all sent away, with the exception of Thomas Flynn and William Lang, two young men, aged about 21 or 22 years, and two young ladies. About 12 o'clock, Thomas Flynn went into the bedroom to examine the corpse and was horrified to see three cats on the body. He tried to drive them away by motioning with his hands, but they showed fight. He then seized a poker and commenced belaboring them with it, and they attacked him, and it was all he could do with the assistance of the other watchers, whom his cries for aid summoned to drive them from the room. The window was then closed, and cats of all sizes, colors, age, and both sexes jumped on the windowsill and sprang against the glass, with their eyes blazing and their fur all standing the wrong way. Finding they could not force an entrance there, they went to the roof and endeavored to tear off the shingles. They got under the floor and sought for an entrance. Their screams, yells, and groans in the meantime were frightening to listen to, and so scared the watchers that they were almost paralyzed with fear. The ghoulish beast failed to effect an entrance, and the watchers felt relieved. But it was soon discovered that they could not remain in the house with all the windows closed, as the odor from the corpse was too offensive. As the window was raised again, but not enough to admit a cat. Then the window was again assailed, and it seemed to the guardians of the remains that there were at least 100 felines trying to force an entrance. Flynn stood at the window with the poker and beat them over the head, but they persisted in the effort to effect an entrance. Finally, some of them got part of their bodies through, and the window was closed down on them. Two pokers heated red hot, and the beast burned in every possible way. The young people thinking it would drive them away, but it did not, and the fight was kept up at intervals until after daylight. The watchers kept the window down as long as they could possibly bear the stench, and when they could do so no longer, it would be raised, and the war raged on both sides. It was a remarkable occurrence, the like of which was probably never known in that part of the country. The watchers looked next morning like they had a long spell of sickness, and say they would not pass through another such ordeal for the world. Some 9 or 10 dead cats were found around the premises the next morning. Now, I don't know about you, but that's a story. They don't write them like that anymore. Who knows what the reality of the situation was, if there even was such a thing, but my goodness. How about one more? This is another particular favorite of mine, although it doesn't necessarily fit our theme of obituaries and the macabre. Since we've got a few moments left, I'll close out with a National Police Gazette article from January 11th, 1879, titled "A Horrible Scene." The famous lager beer drinking bear of Coney Island seizes a young lad at his play and crushes him to death before the eyes of horrified spectators. The premises known as the Clubhouse, kept by William S. Thorns on the Ocean Parkway at Parkville, about 2 miles from the Brooklyn city line, was the scene of a tragical occurrence, their word, on Monday afternoon the 30th, when a boy lost his life in a terrible manner. The victim was a bright and interesting child of 13 years, the son of Samuel Stretch, a respectable working man residing in the village. And his slayer was a bear that was supposed to be tame and harmless. About 2:30 on that afternoon, Peter Stretch, the deceased, was in the company of 2 younger brothers and 2 boys named John Bush and John Morn. According to custom of late, the boys took a seat on the box beneath the horse shed adjoining the clubhouse above mentioned, where 2 large bears, male and female, were chained. After some time had elapsed, they rose from their seats and began to play and shout. Young Bush ran around the bears once or twice, when Peter Stretch undertook to follow him. As he was passing round the male bear, which was named Ben, the animal stood on his hind leg, and when the boy's back was turned, he reached out his forepaw, grabbing him by the leg, drew him toward him. the child who was 13 years of age, feeling the claws penetrating his tender flesh, screamed, and his companions joined in the chorus. But in an instant, Bruin, bent on the death of his human prey, had drawn the screaming boy to his deadly embrace. Clasping his vice-like paws, one across each shoulder, he stifled the cries of the poor boy and then with savage ferocity implanted his huge fangs an inch deep into the right side of the neck of the little fellow, cutting the jugular vein and killing him. While the struggle, which according to eyewitnesses did not last more than 2 minutes, was taking place, a stableman seized a pitchfork and thrust it into the side of the brute. Mr. Toms, who was sitting by the stove in his hotel a few yards away, on hearing the outcry, rose from his chair and looking out the window saw the trouble. He lost not an instant, but seizing a bell stick that was at hand, he struck the bear several violent blows with it, compelling the animal to relinquish his hold. Medical assistance was summoned immediately, but it was to no avail. While sympathetic hands were busy, the mother of the deceased rushed in frantically upon the scene, and in her maternal frenzy insisted that her child was not dead and that a little brandy would revive him. To gratify her, that stimulant was produced, but of course it was useless. During the struggle, the she-bear, who is known as Kate, stood up on her hind legs and glared upon the murderous work of her mate. But she neither growled nor did she make any attempt to go near him, Ben having been beaten off. Ben proceeded, to the horror of the spectators, to lap the gore from his paws. Officer Miller of the Flatbush Police was then called on to shoot the brute, and he fired no less than 5 bullets into its head. This had not the desired effect, however, and young Ravenhall procured a shotgun, loaded heavy with number 3 shot, which he fired into the left shoulder of Ben. Still, Bruin writhed, and Mr. Ravenhall Sr. stabbed the animal with a long dirk knife, while Mr. Thomas struck him several blows to the head with an axe, finally dispatching him effectively. The bears during the summer were kept at the Garrett Caton's Inn at Coney Island, where they had always been docile and well-behaved, never showing any dangerous temper. They would frequently go into the bar with people and drink lager beer out of bottles, pulling the corks out themselves, often consuming from 40 to 50 bottles a day. Sometimes they would get a little full and act as though they were under the influence of the beer, but it is said that they were always clever and well-behaved. They had no beer on the day of the fatal occurrence. What a story. What a horrible, what a story. Well, I would say I hope you've enjoyed this edition of Dragon King Dark, but hey, I kind of hope you haven't. Tales of the Macabre. The show's almost turning into, one of those old 1950s comic series as I sit back and laugh maniacally at these dark tales. So, my website is DragonKingCarl.com. Please visit it. I hope you've enjoyed the show, you sick freaks. So, that's it. Be back. Show number 16. Who knows what comes next? I may make this the Dragon King Dark Reads the Police Gazette. Who knows? Thanks a lot for listening. I can't possibly follow that. Good night.
How did you happen to get in here?
I ran here. You scared the daylights out of me last night.
Seems like the truth shouldn't scare anybody. Man or boy.
What's the matter, Lieutenant? Is this thing getting you?
Oh, no. I'm just thinking about public reaction to all this.